Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Fully podcast.
What antiques are we talking about this week?
We're going to talk about ironstone.
Shout out to Kate in the Antiques Freaks Friends Facebook group for suggesting ironstone.
And good timing, because it's here. So ironstone is pottery. It's a type of vitreous pottery. Comes from the UK. It was developed in the early 19th century. It is patented by Charles James Mason in 1813. However, it was patented for the use of the word ironstone. No one's really sure who actually came up with the formula, who invented ironstone as it were. Possibly James Edwards of Dalehall Pottery. Possibly William Turner of Longton Pottery, who upon death had turned over the recipe to Josiah Spode. What we do know is that Spode was exporting a kind of extremely heavy, durable, what they called English china, to France in 1805. So ironstone had existed for a while. It got cooked up because in the 1780s, there was a halt on exports from China, Japan, all of those places. And Charles James Mason, who had primarily worked as an importer, decided to contract out a bunch of potters in Stoke-on-Trent to come up with an alternative. And at the same time, they make a cheaper, better alternative to porcelain. And what they came up with was ironstone, a really, like, heavy vitreous pottery that was a nice creamy white that would take transfer and look just like the actual China porcelain coming from China.
Cool.
What's extremely notable, and I think probably the most misunderstood thing about ironstone, it does not contain iron.
What?
Yeah. This is a misconception that comes mostly from Charles James Mason himself. In the patent, he lists ironstone slag as an ingredient in making ironstone, which is not true and is confusing, because ironstone, in addition to, you know, kind of being a composite term of iron and stone, is also like a natural mineral.
Oh.
Ironstone has none of that in it. Best guess is that he actually put this down as a means of industrial misinformation.
Oh.
Tricking people into thinking you've given them the recipe, when you would find, I think, that trying to put any kind of, like, feldspar or iron slag in your pottery would just ruin it. Now, there is some metal in it. The earliest ironstone was actually made out of a nice heavy Cornwall clay and a lot of cobalt added in. I always balk every time because cobalt is pretty much not going to be a mineral in the next 10 years. At the time, it was incredibly plentiful and very cheap to work with. And cobalt is a form of very heavy metal. But what makes ironstone so strong and durable is mostly the firing technique. Good quality heavy clay and a extended very high firing. So yeah, ironstone mostly just refers to the fact that it's very strong. There's no iron in it. Early on, it was decorated largely to resemble exported porcelain, because that was the niche that it was being made to fill. Eventually, you would just get it in plain white. Although, saying plain white, if you say that to an ironstone enthusiast, they will correct you. It is never white. Most people will describe it as having a blue, gray, or cream cast.
Like the Sega cream cast?
Yes, like my favorite video game platform, the Sega Creamcast. God. Ironstone is also entirely opaque. You can shine a light through it all day and never actually see any translucency in it. This is, of course, because it is a vitreous pottery. Other than typical transfer decorations, particularly blue, although you do see a lot of brown, you can also see raised patterning molded into the piece. And what's more is the insanely strong build of ironstone meant that you could make unheard of large pieces out of it. They withstood so much pressure and abuse. You can find, they are extremely expensive, you can find vestibule vases that are 1.5 meters high.
That's a lot.
They are tremendously heavy, and in some very rare cases, there were whole mantelpieces made out of ironstone.
Damn.
Yeah, like multi-part, like you just put it together like a puzzle and you've got an ironstone mantelpiece.
Damn, dog.
Yeah. When Mason's patent ended in 1827, immediately over 100 different pottery companies began producing and marketing ironstone as ironstone, to the point where ironstone went from a specific brand to a general term for the kind of pottery that it was. Some of those companies include Old Midway, Rawdon, Spode, Spode and Copeland, T&R Boot, which should always be in caps. And later, after the U.S. picked up on ironstone manufacture, you get Empire, Onondaga Pottery, which would later be renamed to Syracuse China, Walter Scott Lennox, yes, that Lennox, Homer Laughlin, J&G Meakin, among hundreds of others. One thing I thought was really cool is that there's been a bunch of tests, and generally, I'm going to say generally because I'm not going to stake anyone's like safety over this, generally, ironstone wasn't lead glazed.
A rarity.
A rarity, exactly. And because it's a vitreous pottery, which means that it is not permeable by water, it is not porous any longer, as long as it doesn't have any major defects in the surface, you could pretty safely, you know, eat off of these.
For once.
For once. I know, everyone's holding their breath going, oh my god, I can use these? I will say that is not the case with, like, with crazing and that kind of, like, surface damage. I would be pretty hesitant. Mostly for bacterial reasons.
Bacteria love a pour.
Bacterial love a pour. You may have guessed from the number of times I've said it that the main hallmark of ironstone is that it is heavy.
Much like iron.
Much like iron. A piece should always be much heavier than it looks. In fact, some of the finest pieces have a grace that belies how extremely heavy they are. Any piece of ironstone worth its salt should have pretty much no translucency. You don't get a lot of decorative pieces of ironstone. You do rarely. Like I said, we did talk about mantelpieces and hall vases, but most of the time they were being used at, you get a lot of, there's tons of chamber pots for one. Because a chamber, everyone needed at least like two. So you get a lot of chamber pots, washstand vases, very popularly made of ironstone. Cups, plates, just stuff that get knocked around. Although the old ironstone cups and plates don't come in sets anymore, so there were lots of markings, of course, because ironstone had been patented before the patent ran out. In addition to ironstone, there was stone china, semi-porcelain, English porcelain, new stone, and opaque porcelain. All right, this one, I don't get this one exactly, but people talk about the luster of ironstone. I think this is just one of those things that antiques people just kind of get into that is, like, impossible to be translated, like certain words. I think it refers to the, like, heavy shine of the glaze on a high-quality piece.
Sure.
Another fun thing about it is that, up to a point, you can actually kind of date them based on what they look like. And I love anything that can be visually dated. So the earliest pieces of English ironstone, you're looking at 1810s to the 1840s, were really geometric and clunky-looking. You see octagon... I'm gonna take that again. You see octagons...
I don't know. I kind of liked octagon.
Octagons.
It had a certain charm to it.
A lot of, like, you know, geometric angular shapes. More than once I've seen people describe them as kind of more masculine, which I don't like gendering objects. But if that helps you understand it, I would just stick with geometric. Then you move into the 1850s, where you get a gentle introduction of foliate designs and patterning being molded into the piece. Moving into the 1860s, where you start getting wheat, grapes, ribbons, and other kind of harvest-themed designs, again, still being molded into the piece. This was called farmerware or thresherware, and was being made almost explicitly just to export to the U.S., who, for some reason, they decided liked to look at wheat.
Sure.
Although I have seen it called wheatware if it's specifically just the wheat. And then you move into the 1880s, where you start seeing Baroque Rococo-influenced styling. Just a lot of, like, pointless, pretty ornaments. And the introduction of smooth and round forms. After the 1880s, the U.S. picks up making ironstone, and the idea of design kind of goes fully haywire. As everything does, I think, once it starts reaching being manufactured in the U.S., oh, one fun thing I learned. This is an interesting point where crazing actually in a lot of pieces can add to the value of a piece.
Really?
Here's a dark secret about ironstone that you probably already know. It is the sweetheart of interior design.
Is it?
Absolutely. Because it is white.
Oh.
Overwhelmingly. It is white and its shapes are not generally extravagant.
So it can go with anything.
So it can go with anything for a really long time. If you wanted to have a cottage chic or like a farmer, a farmhouse chic is a thing that I actually saw multiple times. It turns out ironstone was completely integral to that look.
Oh.
And a lot of those people, depending on what kind of a look they're going for, but obviously what you're looking at is something more rustic. The crazing, which especially in ironstone tends to come with a browning kind of stain, as long as it was visually pleasant, was considered a plus.
Oh.
You know, if you're into pottery, you know that crazing can actually be a pretty strong indicator of whether or not something's genuine, because fake crazing is pretty easy to spot once you get an eye for its uniformity. It can be very personal, but browning stains and crazing really don't affect the value. I've seen some that I really didn't like. You can clean those. Never, ever, ever use bleach on anything that you like, because bleach will ruin it. You can use hydrogen peroxide.
Oh.
And the sun. That's pretty much it. You rub on some hydrogen peroxide, you leave it in the sun. It might take multiple treatments, but it's surefire and it does not damage the integrity of the piece.
Nice.
You can also do baking soda if it's not really, like, baked in. I think that is why a lot of people use toothpaste.
Oh.
Yeah, the secret ingredient in the toothpaste is baking soda. It's nothing about the toothpaste inherent. So I thought that was neat. I never thought about cleaning it because I really like the brown staining in ironstone. Pretty much all rare pieces are just stuff that would have gotten broken. Gravy boats and soup tureens that have finials that are intact are really big.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This was surprising to me. Ladles.
Ladles.
Yeah, there was no amount of strength of ironstone that turns out could prevent you from breaking pretty much just a straw made out of a breakable material.
Yeah, I can see where that would be difficult.
It's one of those things that when you get it, it clicks and you're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. For a different reason, cake stands are extremely rare. I have heard that they jump to the thousands pretty much the second they exist. I don't know why this is. I'm wondering if it's because its shape is, of course, more given to breaking, or if it's just because in a utilitarian market, fewer people would be in demand of a cake stand.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know. I mentioned it just because, you know, if you see an ironstone cake stand, keep a sharp eye out, because that might be worth a lot. Other rare pieces, of course, are like actual Masons Company pieces. Since they got the branding, they're kind of considered like the creme de la creme of like the historical collecting. Although I guess you could argue that the Spode French exports, they're older and as thus more desirable in the general way antiques tend to go. But the Spodes aren't marked. Actually, a lot of things before Mason patents the term will not be marked, and that gets super confusing. You do have to really rely on a lot of, like, provenance and then just features about the piece to kind of start trying to tell if it is one of those older pieces. Because bad news, the fact that the most popular versions of ironstone are plain white means that there are tons of reproductions. It is, unfortunately, very easy to fake. Especially since the interior designers do tend to like the unadorned, simpler pieces best. Crazing, of course, can be your very first entry into whether or not something is real or fake. Crazing should always be random, uneven, sometimes different concentrations in different areas, and will have varying depths of possible staining. It is possible to fake craze something, but I find to a piece these are always uniformly spread. They don't have like heavy concentrations in certain areas. When you pay attention, you can see the repeats, you know?
Yeah.
The color can matter. I was hesitant to even introduce this because this seems like that kind of like expert thing. Old ironstone always kind of has a gray or bluish cast that unfortunately has never been able to be reproduced. And you can double check this against the bottom of the piece where the glaze tends to be a little thinner. You can kind of see the natural color that comes through. And while there are cream and white examples that are older, it is described as having a depth that the new stuff can't ever copy. It's an unevenness of color deposit, I think, is what they're talking about. My favorite, all right, my go-to is think a celebrity's fake teeth.
Just think about veneers.
Think about veneers, because human teeth are variations of cream and white, right? But they're all, like, different, and they're all uneven. And when you see a horrible veneer, you can immediately clock that as not correct. Kind of get that same effect out of ironstone. An old ironstone will be like regular teeth, with normal imperfections and variations of color. The new stuff is celebrity veneer white.
Gotcha.
The weight, obviously. It is more expensive now to produce this kind of, like, high-quality, heavy pottery. So a lot of people who are reproducing it just don't. sometimes they'll rely on kind of like a really heavy base to kind of give it weight, and this is harder to explain, but the originals have a chunky, sort of like handcrafted build that the new ones don't have. The new ones will always go for like the hyperplane look, and that tends to give away that they're not as heavy, not as chunky, not as solidly built. Some makers are actually just sort of dead giveaways. Pretty much anything from Japan. I'm not going to call that a reproduction necessarily, because some of them are contemporary pieces being made in the 70s. Although you do see reproductions in the 80s and 90s coming from Japan. Johnson Brothers, not reproductions. Those are contemporary pieces being made into the 70s and 80s. I pretty much just don't mess with Johnson Brothers anymore. I don't like the amount of work that goes into authenticating the old ones. And McCoy was also not reproduction, but was manufacturing contemporary restaurant wear well into the 2000s. I'm not saying to not deal with the Johnson Brothers. A lot of it is good stuff. It's really nice, although it is going to be on the lower end of the price no matter what, just because of how many there were. But you just definitely need to know that, like, if it's too good to be true and it's a Mark Johnson Brothers, you're probably looking at a 1970s piece.
Gotcha.
You can also try to tell if the marking is fired under the glaze or stamped over it. This is tricky. It's pretty much just like, is there some sort of light refraction going on between the marking and your eye? Or it can be very easy. Sometimes the paint they use to stamp over just kind of flakes away, and that's a pretty good tell that it's a reproduction, because not a reproduction would have the marking fired underneath the glaze. Some other companies make this extremely easy by just putting dumb shit on their pieces. I have seen in person pieces that are marked flow blue.
Huh.
This, of course, specific to a piece of ironstone that has a flow blue transfer wear pattern. If you're not familiar with that, it is a pattern that has been intentionally messed with so that it loses its clarity and has kind of a blurry, smudged look.
Pretty sure we did an episode on it.
Yeah. So if you want to know more about that, you can go to it. I saw someone say, if you imagine someone walking in and asking for the flow blue and it sounds stupid to you, then you shouldn't trust it as a marking. which I really like, you know, I think this is excising, don't imagine that in an antique store, because obviously you could do that there, but like, go back to the 1890s and picture a man walking into a department store and saying, show me the flow blue, he would look like an idiot.
Yeah.
So if you see a stamp that says flow blue, and that does exist, that is fake. Also, ironware. If something is marked ironstone, it almost always is accompanied by the company that was making it. And notably, no company ever actually used the term ironware. That is, again, much like someone walking in and asking for the flow blue. It's dumb. It's not real. Of course, that gets tricky. You do need to, like, get familiar with all the markings. And that's more or less impossible. But, you know, we have the internet now, and it's easier than ever to just sort of Google stuff on the go. I mentioned glazing. Glazing is super important for reproductions because for some reason, they just don't glaze the parts that you can't see on the piece they're reproducing. This comes up a lot with bases and feet. More tellingly is rims where lids sit and things like that. Undersides of handles and the rim where a lid sits. For some reason, they never think to glaze it, and the original pieces would always be glazed there. And other dumb shit. Things that just plain old weren't being made out of ironstone. Nobody made any citrus reamers. That's fake.
Fake citrus.
Little tiny novelty oil lamp. That is stupid. Why would anyone use that? It was fake. It's not real. that one gets me because I'm trying to, like, if you're approaching this logically, you're going, all right, what did anyone use this comically small, like, oil lamp for? That's ironware.
That's ironware.
If you're serious about ironware, I found some really cool resources. WhiteIronstoneChina.com and JanicePaul with two L's.com. And AdirondackGirlAtHeart.com all have really cool price guides giving general prices. Pricing, of course, is super strange when you get to utilitarian pieces. I find overall ironstone is extremely affordable. I don't run into a lot of pieces that are over $100. But then again, I'm also a casual who doesn't, like, you know, I don't deal in the investment pieces. But all of those, they have price guides and marking guides that'll really help you get acquainted with what the markings should look like. And kind of give you a rough idea if a price is fair for something you're looking at.
Right on.
One of my favorite things about ironstone, if you'll allow me a dumb aside, butter pats. They're not rare per se, and they're certainly not expensive, but there's something very exciting about finding an ironstone butter pat. I don't even know how to... They're not even scarce, but, like, they are harder to find, and it's just so fun. I don't know, man. Butter pats are great. I love ironstone, though. You cannot break that stuff.
It's nice to have a ceramic that I can depend upon.
Exactly. And, I mean, I'm a sucker for transferware. I think the transferware pieces are gorgeous. If you're interested in, like, primarily in reselling them, I also really think that ironstone can be really cool because you can do a lot with imperfect pieces if you're selling to designers. They are not always super concerned about condition as they are about aesthetic. Because, you know, if someone's doing, like, a super rustic farmhouse, then, like, nobody's gonna notice chips on the lid or whatever, you know?
And also, if you're deliberately going for the rustic farmhouse style, it's probably not being used as it would be in a farmhouse.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to stay on a counter, probably.
And be looked at twice a year when the owners visit.
Oh, you. But yeah, probably. So yeah, that is our wide, wonderful world of ironstone and how I didn't realize that interior designers loved it so much, somehow. Despite working with interior designers for years.
Yay! Learning!
Our sources from today include AdirondackGirlAtHeart.com. Despite being an interior designer, she is extremely well-versed in ironstone.
I feel like despite it being an interior designer is kind of a rude way to put that.
I'm sorry, that was really mean, yeah. Okay, like, alright. Well, they're not usually historians.
I feel like they're knowledgeable.
That's true, alright. I apologize, Adirondack Girl at Heart. And I found your resources very useful. MissMustardSeed.com, another extremely helpful interior designer. And ThePotteries.org. They have a number of articles on ironstone, all of which are exhaustively interesting, fascinating, and excellent resources for learning about different marks, different years, and gosh, if you just want to know all the boring bits and bobs about Charles James Mason.
Right on. If you would like to show us your ironstone, or suggest other topics for us to cover, or just say hello, you can email us directly, antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com, or post in our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, or tag us on Tumblr, antiquesfreaks.tumblr.com.
If you liked all of these words that we said out of our mouths, consider scrolling on down to wherever you're listening to this podcast and leaving us a review. Any kind of review is great, even weird ones.
And if you would like to listen to deleted scenes or our special bonus episode presentation of the Penny Dreadful Varney the Vampire, or if you would like to see special drag story time readings of The Gentleman's Art of Dressing with Economy.
And you should want that.
You should check out our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and filling our hearts with love.
So much love.
And thank you in particular for listening.
That's right, you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.